the form that we see Hebrew poetry, the poetry of the Psalms, in so many of our editions of the Bible, so many of our versions. And if we look carefully, we can see some things, but not quite as obviously as we might see them if we looked at it in maybe this kind of a structure. And there's one thing that I hope pops out a little better in this kind of a structure. It's that we have in every other line the same thought: for his steadfast love endures forever. Other versions: for his loving kindness is everlasting, for his mercy endures forever. Different sentiments, but every other line is that way, down to the end of the poem, verse 26, which is of course off the slide here. Now, that's not a bad way of looking at the psalm, and some of the more recent versions have laid out poetry, Hebrew poetry, as poetic structure rather than in paragraph form. It helps us to see things a little more clearly, and especially when you put the lines that go together, you can see correspondences. And that's why one thing that I did some years ago, it was quite beneficial, was to look at this psalm. What would it look like if we took out these repeating lines? Now, I think in use in worship, that the leader would read the first line or pronounce the first line, and his audience would respond with the second line. And that line was, of course, one thought all the way through. It's really the focus and the reason for the rest of the poem. It was interesting, I was somewhere where I dealt with this a little bit, and someone said, we're glad you didn't have us read it responsively, because we have a lot of ex-Roman Catholics in our group here, and they would object to that. I hope that's not objectionable if we do get to the point where we're going to do that, and we will at the end of this session. We will read this responsively. And of course, we don't want to read that in a repetitious, tired sort of way. We want to understand what it means, why it's important, and we want to read it intelligently and not as just repeating something that has no meaning for us. So I, a number of years ago, did separate out, and you can see how we can do that and maintain the what we call the antiphonal line here. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is God, for his steadfast love endures forever. But I want to do something even more radical and just remove those lines altogether. Not that we're altering scripture, I just want us to be able to focus in on one part for a few moments, and then we'll return to consider the whole psalm together. I can see here that we have the same kind of techniques that I've spoken of earlier, the corresponding lines. Right here in the beginning, we have three that go together. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, to the God of gods. Oh, give thanks to the Lord of lords. Now, the casual reader of this psalm will surely miss many of the finer points, and I've structured it this way so that we can focus on those things. A form indeed is poetry. It has this repeated line structure. It's interesting if we look into Scripture, we find that actually this psalm was used a couple times. We find in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, this psalm was used. It was used another time. Let me find the other time that it was used. I'm sure if I follow my notes, I'll run across that. It was used in 2 Chronicles 7 and was sung at the dedication ceremony of Solomon's temple. It was also sung during the reign of Jehoshaphat, and I hate to say it, but I don't think I have the reference recorded here, but the first mention in 2 Chronicles 7:3 is during the dedication of Solomon's temple, project that came to completion, and this was sung to commemorate the completion of the temple and give thanks to God. It was sung during the reign of Jehoshaphat as they entered into combat against the Ammonites and the Moabites. And we should know that the Israelites won that battle. So on two types of occasions, this song was used in worship. Again, we get into that repeated line for his steadfast love endures forever. Again, that word chesed that I mentioned and you're now familiar with, a demonstration of God's faithfulness and his loyalty towards his covenant people. And it's based on this relationship of the covenant. These are all things we're going to find out that are evidence of God's faithfulness, his covenant loyalty to his people. What remains after we take out those lines is a complete poem with units of between 1 and 3 lines. I mentioned here that we have 1, 2, 3 right at the beginning. The main point, I'll give thanks to the Lord for he is good. That's the one big idea. We always, we teach our students homiletics and the Bible Institute, and I don't teach that course. This is coming secondhand. The students are taught to look for the big idea. You know, after you've done all of your analytical work, there should be a central idea that comes through, and you should be able to express that in 1 or 2 sentences. And the big idea here, obviously, is that we're to give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. And then we get all of these evidences of God's goodness towards his people. Now, give thanks to the Lord is repeated 3 times at the beginning, and again at the end. Give thanks to the God of heaven for his steadfast love endures forever. And we get a sort of a little sandwich here. You know, the thought, main thought at the beginning, main thought at the end. Technique that's we do find in a number of the Psalms. Technically, it's called inclusio. I think sandwich is a better term. We've got the bread on both ends. The meat's in the middle, by the way, and the giving thanks holds that all together. There are 7 other lines that are directly connected to this main idea. Oh, give thanks to the Lord. Give thanks to the Lord. To him who, and we read, to him who, 7 times, to him who alone does great wonders, to him who by understanding made the heavens, spread out the earth, made the great lights, smote the firstborn of Egypt, led his people through the wilderness, smote great kings. We see... Pardon? 13. Yeah. The seven times are 4, 5, 6, 7, 13, 16, and 17. And actually, 25 is pretty close. It's not completely that structure, but he brings us back to that thought just before he finishes it off. So we see the importance of this idea. Four times in the psalm, we find verbs in the imperative mood. A command or an exhortation. Give thanks. Give thanks, give thanks, give thanks. And again at the end, give thanks. So the psalmist, when he was composing this, he was thinking about exhorting people to do just that, to give thanks to the Lord. And so we might ask, well, what's the basis of the thanks? What is it that we're giving thanks to the Lord for? And of course, we get the repeated, for His mercy, His steadfast loyalty, His kindness, etc., is everlasting, it's enduring. And now, as we get into the psalm, we find out that there's a pattern, there's a structure here. But before that, I want to focus in on this little, what we call a clause here, for He is good. The whole thing is about the goodness of God. And the psalmist here uses the same expression that we find in Genesis 1 that God used to evaluate His own work. God said, let there be light. Lo and behold, light appeared, and God said that it was good. God created a good creation. That was His own evaluation of what He produced in creation. Let me go off on a little side trail here and say that I think that's important because in Greek philosophy, you know, material things, trees and bodies and flesh and these material things were considered to be inherently sinful, inherently wicked, inherently corrupt, actually is a better word. And I think, unfortunately, to a certain extent, Roman Catholic theology has incorporated that idea. And it's not the creation that is wicked. There's nothing wicked about a tree. There's nothing wicked about being human. Sin is a relationship between the creature and the creator. And it's man's willful disobedience that is at the heart of sin. The creation that God created is good. And that's His evaluation. That has some implications for some other aspects of theology, but I think it's worth mentioning that there's nothing sinful about the earth just because it was created as earth. And God said it was good. Okay, now here the psalmist is saying, the Lord is good, and that's why we should give thanks to Him. In one sense, we could say that all of God's creation, as we said back there in Psalm 19, is evidence of His goodness. He's a good God. He created a good creation. And the psalmist here says, we should give thanks to God for His goodness. And he's got a history lesson here to give us to prove that God is good and has been good to His people through the ages. Okay, the structure is as follows. If we look at verses 4 through 9, we ought to notice how similar the ideas expressed there are to what we find in Genesis 1. In fact, verses 7 and 8 come from Genesis 1, I believe 1:16, and you know the idea is, it's just as if he's quoting from Genesis 1. And so when the listeners heard this psalm in the times of David or in the period of the monarchy, they certainly would have recognized that the psalmist here is talking about what God did in creation. To him who alone does great wonders, and to him who by understanding made the heavens, to him who spread out the earth upon the waters, to him who made the great lights, the sun to rule over the day, and the moon and stars to rule over the night. Okay? So Genesis 1 is the context for these first verses. And we see here God as the creator. All men receive blessing from creation. So these verses, we could say that these apply not just to the Israelites, but to all of his creatures. So we could say it's a little broader here in the beginning. And God's creation is evidence of his goodness, not just towards his covenant people, but to everyone, everywhere, at all times. Verses 10 through 24, we get more of a history lesson here, but it takes us in sort of a chronological sequence quickly down through Israel's history. Exodus 4, chapters 4 through 13 are the setting for verses 10, 11, and 12. To him who smote the firstborn of Egypt and brought Israel out from among them with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. This expression, a strong hand and an outstretched arm, is an expression we find repeated, especially in the book of Deuteronomy. Let me read from Deuteronomy chapter 4, just really quickly to give you a broader understanding. In verse 32, he says, "Ask now of the days that are past," and here Moses is giving some of his final words to the Israelites before he's ready to depart. "Ask now of the days that are past, which were before you, since the day that God created man upon the earth, and asked from one end of heaven to the other, whether such a great thing has ever happened or was ever heard of." What great thing was that? He says, "Did any people ever hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire, as you have heard, and still live?" This is what happened. You know, they were encamped down there at the foot of Mount Sinai, and they heard things going on up there on the top of the mountain, Moses and his 40 days up there, and other experiences up there. Actually, at one point, God called the 70 or 72 elders from the tribes to come and approach the mountain because he wanted to speak with them as representatives of the people. And a certain area was, shall we say, cordoned off, that the Israelites knew, you go up to this point no farther, because you start climbing this mountain, the Lord's going to take you out, so to speak. Only Moses had the special privilege. Joshua, as his adjutant, went along with him certain times, but the people knew that the mountain was off limits. One time, God called the people, their representatives, and they came near, and they heard the thunder and the lightning, and they started shaking their boots, and they said to Moses, you intervene for us, because we're too frightened. We're afraid we're going to die. And the Lord spoke to Moses, and he said, "It's a good thing that they have this kind of fear for me. They have spoken well in responding this way." Now, it's a shame that they didn't have the same kind of relationship with the Lord that Moses had. God spoke to Moses, and the expression he uses is face to face, special relationship. I should mention that in the New Testament, this is just to tickle your imagination, you'll have to follow this up later on your own, but in the accounts where Jesus takes the three disciples and they go up on the Mount of Transfiguration. If you take a close look sometime, you'll see that there's a lot of correspondences between what happened with Moses on Mount Sinai and with what happens when Jesus takes his three disciples up there. Of course, they go up there and there's Moses and Elijah that the disciples identified. And how they identified Moses and Elijah, I don't know. They probably had photographs that somebody took of Moses that they recognized. But some way or another, they recognized Moses and Elijah. I remember I asked my seminary professor how they did that, and he told me not to ask any more questions. So I'm still waiting for an answer. But there's a lot of correspondence, and I think the importance of the correspondence is that the voice comes out of the cloud that says, "This is my beloved son, listen to him." That we're entering into a new phase. And Hebrews 1 says, you know, Jesus is better than Moses. He's better than the angels. He's better than anything you've ever experienced before. And I think that when Peter blurts out, "Hey, let's make three tabernacles," and that's when the voice comes. No, we're not up here to worship Moses. We're not up here to worship Elijah. You want to know who's important? Jesus Christ. He's the one that is my beloved son, and you should hear him. Getting back to our psalm, the smiting of the firstborn of Egypt, bringing Israel out with a strong hand and outstretched arm, leads me back to continue my reading from Deuteronomy 4. What thing happened? Did any people ever hear the voice of a God speaking out of the midst of the fire as you have heard and still live? Or has any God ever attempted to take a nation for himself from the midst of another nation by trials, by signs, by wonders, or by war, or by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, according to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? To you it was shown that you might know that the Lord is God, there is no other besides him. Out of heaven he let you hear his voice, that he might discipline you. And on earth he let you see his great fire, and you heard his words out of the midst of the fire. And because he loved your fathers and chose their descendants after them, and brought you out of Egypt with his own presence by his great power, that he did these things. An expression, a strong hand and an outstretched arm. The strong hand is pretty straightforward. You know, God demonstrated that he's got the power. But it's one thing to have a strong arm, it's another thing to use it. And he didn't just flex and show that he had strong hand. No, he had an outstretched arm. He got involved personally with the battle, and it was his arm that taught the lesson to Pharaoh, and certainly was not a result of anything that the Israelites themselves did, that he was able to win their freedom for them. Then in verses 13, 14, 15, we move into Exodus 14 and 15. To him who divided the Red Sea in sunder, made Israel pass through the midst of it, but overthrew Pharaoh and his host in the Red Sea. It would be great if one of the modern filmmakers would try to use the special effects to do this. I know we all grew up with Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments, and that's pretty good, but special effects are a little cheesy now after so many years. But I think it's terrific the way the waters separate so clearly, because we do have in that Exodus 15 song of the sea a little phrase that seems to indicate that as they walk through the midst, they saw the seas congealed, as it is. It's the same word that's used for curds of cheese. So I don't think it was just a low tide. I don't think it was anything that was, you could give it another interpretation. I think it was very clear to them that something fantastic was happening, and they knew that God was doing something pretty fantastic for them. In verses 16, 17, and 18, we get into the book of Numbers. To him who led his people through the wilderness, to him who smote great kings and slew famous kings. Now, as the Israelites were wandering 38 plus years in the wilderness, they had some various experiences with the Lord. At the end of the period, they began to move up the eastern side of the Jordan River into the area we call Transjordan. And they were confronted there by two Amorite kings, Sihon and Og. And the Lord won a victory for them. It was their first, let's say, first battle experience as a nation. Because Joshua fought against the Amalekites that they confronted in the wilderness. But, you know, I think he had a hand-picked group that he used, Joshua, that is. But here the whole nation is confronting two very powerful kings of the Amorites. And in one passage it talks about how one of these kings, I believe it was Og, that he's got this bed that's pretty long because he's a tall, powerful guy. But the Lord won a victory for him. That was their first experience. You know, when they came out of Egypt, they're just a mob of slaves. They don't know anything about military warfare. They don't know anything about a well-organized unit. And one of the things that, besides the fact that they were being disciplined for their lack of faith at Kadesh Barnea, one of the things that those 38 years allowed them to accomplish was that they were given regulations and some training to function as a military operation. The Lord knew that they were going to have to go into the Promised Land and fight some battles in order to take the land. That the Canaanites weren't just going to open up the gates and say, "Here it is, boys, it's all yours, come on in." That's not what happened. So he gives them the first taste of victory. This is even before, you know, that battle at Jericho, which is totally of the Lord. I mean, there's nothing that you could say about Jericho that is glorifies in any way the Israelites. They took a walk around the city a few times, and they blew some trumpets, and just the walls fell down. I mean, that's the Lord's doing all the way, certainly. But with Sihon and Og, these two Amorite kings, it was the same thing. The Lord won a victory for them. That was their first taste of victory, as the first chance for them to see that, yes, the Lord would be faithful to them as they entered the land. And then in verses 21 and 22, we have verses that have reference to what happened in the days of Joshua. We have after Jericho, we have three short battles. First battle was against Bethel and Ai, as they took Jericho, which gave them access to a route that led into the highlands. And obviously the first time they go against Ai, there's this sin of Achan that causes defeat for them. Real good lesson, actually following up what we were talking about with Psalm 32. They experienced defeat in their walk with the Lord because of sin. that was not properly dealt with. Took care of that sin, and then the Lord won a marvelous victory. And I think one thing that's really interesting to me is, you know, in the case of walled cities, usually how you would take a walled city is to lay siege against it. And now you're talking about anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half, maybe sometimes up to 3 years, to get those people inside to come out, to open up the city gates. And through a ruse, the Lord gave them a victory over Bethel, which was a walled city. And they got the warriors on the inside to come out and open up city gates, and they won a victory and had this city without having to knock down the walls. That was terrific. But after this victory, and then another victory at Gibeon against a confederation of southern kings, they fought another confederation of northern kings, and at this point they were ready to distribute the land out to the various tribes, to cast lots, which is a way of demonstrating that it was the Lord who was giving each tribe its portion. And they distributed out the remaining land, and they received their inheritance. It remained for individual tribes to take possession of the inheritance. There was more work to do, but at this point, all of the confederacies that they would possibly face were dealt with, and they were able to settle down and start the long work of making the promised land their home and their nation. Then we get into Judges, verses 23 and 24. It is he who remembered us in our low estate and rescued us from our foes. Obviously, we get into Judges, and there's that whole long cycle of how he rescued them when they came to the point of turning to the Lord humbly and asking for his help along the lines of the covenant. Again, Leviticus 26. It's the third time that I mentioned Leviticus 26. I hope you go home in the next week or so and read Leviticus 26. Really important. Rescued us from our foes. And then he goes back to a general principle in verse 25. He who gives food to all flesh. And this is very similar, I think, at least to what Jesus talked to his disciples about. He says, look, not even a little sparrow falls to the ground, but that your Father in heaven doesn't take notice. And God has a goodness that extends to all flesh. And Jesus said that in the present age, the rain from heaven falls upon the just and the unjust. God's goodness is not just to Israelites alone, not just to God's people alone, although they certainly enjoy special favor. So he returns again to the central theme, O give thanks to the God of heaven, for his steadfast love endures forever. Now, 26 verses, and I have in the past said that this is Israel's two-minute testimony. One of the things that in the evangelism courses they teach their students is to develop a two-minute testimony. What God has done for you in your life that you can tell somebody in 2 minutes. And we have our students write it out, practice it, and get it to where they can say that in 2 minutes. And the benefit of that is that a lot of people that you meet, you've only got 2 minutes with them. If you start into a long session with them, after 2 minutes they've tuned you out, or after 2 minutes they're running to catch a bus or whatever. But 2 minutes is a good testimony. And we see that this is the short version of Israel's history. You want to get into the long version, you go to 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and that's actually from the Exodus onward. You can add in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It's a long history. I think that we also have a history of God's goodness to us. And we need to think about that on an assembly level. But I think as individuals, we recognize that God has been good to us as well. And I think it's important that we give thanks to the Lord for His goodness, that we remember these good things that God has done for us. I think we also need to develop our two-minute testimony. It's interesting that the Septuagint version of the Psalms has 151 Psalms. That is to say, there's an extra one at the end. Apparently somebody thought that we should continue to write songs and hymns and expressions of our praise to the Lord. When you look at the Qumran scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's another collection of psalms and hymns, which is to say they took seriously this exhortation that we find at least five times in the Psalms. Oh, sing unto the Lord a new song. And so they have additional psalms. And some of those psalms, they took a verse from this psalm, a verse from that psalm, and they created new psalms that were pieced together from verses from other songs. Did God's faithfulness to His people stop here with the period of the judges? No, certainly it continued on. I think we could add some verses, or maybe we should just say we're creating a new poetic expression. Would you be open to reading responsively with me, or I should say repeating? I'm going to read, and I'd like you to respond with the following: "For His steadfast love endures forever." Okay, can we do that all together? "For His steadfast love endures forever." Is that the way I have it? Yeah, that's good. And I'm not reading the psalm. We've just gone over that because I think there's more to be said. But this will serve as a guide to keep us all together. So I'm going to read and you respond. "Give thanks to the Lord, for He is good.
For His steadfast love endures forever.
Give thanks to the God of gods.
For His steadfast love endures forever.
Give thanks to the Lord of lords. To Him who sent His only begotten Son into the world. To Him who made His beloved Son a sacrifice for sin in our place. To Him who gave us the power to become the sons of God." Okay, are you getting tired? It's a little weak there at the end. I'm not sure if you're appreciating the importance of what we're saying here. There's some important ideas here. Let's go back over that again. Maybe we can. That was your dry run. So now we're gonna get it right. "Give thanks to the Lord, for He is good.
For His steadfast love endures forever.
Give thanks to the God of gods.
For His steadfast love endures forever.
Give thanks to the Lord of lords. To Him who sent His only begotten Son into the world.
For His steadfast love endures forever.
To Him who made His beloved Son a sacrifice for sin in our place.
For His steadfast love endures forever.
to Him who gave us the power to become the sons of God.
Your steadfast love endures forever.
Okay, now these ideas certainly apply to all believers everywhere. Now I want to bring it a little closer to home. As individuals, we certainly have experienced God's goodness. And I think we ought to be able to write our own version that speaks to how God has been good to us. And so I have a few more lines that I want to add here. They apply more directly to my case, but maybe you'll choose to write your own version. Give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. To Him who does wonders in my life. To Him who forgave my sins and offenses. To Him who saved me from strong powers. From the power of sin which put me under a death sentence. From the power of death which condemned me to hell without hope. To Him who gave me a loving wife and 5 wonderful children. To Him who supplies all my daily needs in Christ. Give thanks to the Lord, for He is good, for His steadfast love endures forever. Very good. Thank you for your attention, and I hope this has been beneficial to you. I think Ed now is going to come and give maybe some closing announcements and close in a word of prayer.